We're now going to look what the action is for one of these ready spaces. So what we're looking for is an analogue of the Einstein action. It's the integral of the scalar curvature. I won't worry about the signature of the space for the moment. I'll just write root g there. Well, there are various ways of obtaining the Reggie analogue of this. And in his paper, Reggie actually gave a pretty heuristic argument for the formula. So that's what I'll do too. First of all, we can say since the curvature is restricted to the hinges, so in our simplicial space, we expect the action to be a sum of contributions from the hinges. So I'll just write that as capital Fi for the moment. Now, the hinges are homogeneous in the sense that the curvature is distributed all over them. It's not sort of in one place more than any other. So we would expect the contribution from a hinge to be proportional to the volume of that hinge. So expect Fi to be, I'll write this as mod sigma I, that just means the volume of the simplex sigma I, which is an n minus two dimensional simplex, remember, times a function of the deficit angle. We know it's got to depend on the deficit angle. Now, we can consider a hinge as a superposition of two hinges of the same shape and size. And we would expect that the deficit angle that you get, if you take two hinges with the same shape and size, one of them has deficit angle epsilon 1 and another has deficit angle epsilon 2, you'd expect the angle, the deficit of the combined hinges, to be the sum of those two deficit angles. So superposition of two hinges with epsilon 1, epsilon 2 suggests that the epsilon that you get is the sum of those two epsilons. And so we expect F to be an additive function, a linear function. And so we can take the final result that we take is that I is, you actually get a factor of 2 coming in, so you end up with 8 pi g on the bottom. And then the sum over hinges of the volume of the hinge times the deficit angle. So I hope I've indicated to you the general sort of reasoning there. Another way you can get this is to consider parallel transport again. Let's just think about three dimensions. So we'll parallel transport a vector A mu about a collection of hinges. Let's suppose we've got the spaces divided up very finely into symplexes. And we've got a collection of hinges of density.
What is
It's just the n minus two-dimensional subspace where the curvature is. So in four dimensions, it's just the triangles. In three dimensions, it's just the edges. So let's suppose we've got, in some region, we've got a collection of hinges of density rho, and they've all got deficit angle epsilon. You can show that in three dimensions, then the change in the vector when you parallel transport it around this collection of hinges will be the density of hinges times the deficit angle times the anti-symmetric 3/10 times U times A, where what is U? U is a unit vector parallel to the hinge, which is just an edge in this case. And then if you compare that with a standard formula for parallel transport, you get delta A mu is the Riemann tensor R sigma mu alpha beta sigma alpha beta A sigma, where this sigma alpha beta is just epsilon alpha beta gamma, and sigma gamma is the vector area of the loop. That you're transporting. So you've got a hinge, which in three dimensions is an edge, and you're going round this hinge, and U is a vector parallel to it. And in fact, the vector area is also in that direction in this case. And then if you play around with these two formulae, you can actually show that you can represent the Riemann tensor in this case. Sorry. Rho sigma alpha beta. You can represent it by the density of the hinges times the deficit angle times a product of two U's, U rho sigma, U alpha beta, where U rho sigma is a bivector normal to the hinge. So U rho sigma is just epsilon rho sigma lambda times U lambda, that's the definition of it. Yeah?
Does this give also a natural way of writing the Ricci tensor?
Yes, yes. I mean, if you contract this to get the curvature scalar, in fact, then that's a way of getting the Ricci action in terms of the deficit angle and the volume of the simplex. Yeah, well, I guess you can get the Ricci tensor if you just contract two of the indices, yeah. I mean, these are anti-symmetric, so this is the right symmetry properties of the Riemann tensor. And you have to be a bit careful here because the curvature is really a delta function distribution on these hinges, so you have to be careful about writing things like this. You don't have to take it too literally. But certainly that gives another way. So if you contract this, it gives another way of getting the Ricci action. So we've got this formula here. And now we want to vary it with respect to the analog of the metric. We vary it with respect to edge length and use the principle of stationary action. Doesn't matter whether you use an edge length or an edge length squared. I just use an edge length here, LP. And what you will get is dIR by dLP. It's the sum over hinges. And then, first of all, the derivative of the volume times the deficit angle. And then the second term is the volume times the derivative of the deficit angle. Oh, okay, sorry. I'll write out the resulting equations again in a minute. So I've just got two terms from differentiating each of these with respect to LP. And we're going to set that variation equal to zero. Now, Reggie found a very nice simplification of this. We've got two terms here, but in fact, one of these terms just disappears. So, second term is zero. And I'm not going to prove this properly, but I'll give you an indication of why it's zero. Recall that deficit angle, we can write it as 2 pi minus the sum of theta qi. So this is a sum over simplices q meeting at hinge I. And theta qi is the dihedral angle between two faces meeting at hinge I in simplex Q. So in three dimensions, it would just be the ordinary dihedral angle in a tetrahedron, if this is the hinge we're looking at. and then we can say that this, the term here that we're trying to get rid of, so the sum of the volume times d epsilon I by dLP, if we use this formula for epsilon, then the 2 pi obviously disappears, and we get sum over hinges I mod sigma I, be a minus sign, sum over simplices Q meeting at I theta I Q. Now you can actually interchange the order of summation here and write this as minus the sum over simplices Q and then a sum for each simplex. So it'll be sum over hinges I of simplex Q of theta QI times mod sigma I. And this term here is the one that's actually zero. So it's something that happens within a given simplex. So if you took the tetrahedron and varied all the edge lengths, then what you would get would be that the sum of the edge lengths times the variation of each of these dihedral angles in here have to add to zero. Now, there's a proof of this in Reggie's paper. I certainly don't have time to go through it now. It's actually based on the fact that if you have a constant vector and look at the flux of it through a closed surface, you get zero. Or you can also look at it as a form of Stokes' theorem. But this is a fact of simplicity of geometry. And so it has the nice effect that the Regi variational equations become very simple. Sorry, I carried on writing so low there. What am I doing? Oh, sorry, yes, there should be a D. Thank you. Right. Actually missed them out of my notes too, so, yeah. Okay, so the Regi equations that we end up with are... sum over hinges of D... mod sigma by dLP times epsilon equals naught. Now, there seems to be one equation for each edge length, and the edge lengths are the variables, so it looks at first sight as though we've got one equation for each variable, and it looks as though we ought to be able to find a unique solution. Unfortunately, it's not quite as simple as that. And I'll explain why in a few minutes, I hope. What I want to do now is talk about some simplex practicalities, just how you would set about calculating volumes and deficit angles if you wanted to work on this sort of stuff. So obviously, to be able to use it, we've got to do these calculations of volumes and deficit angles. By the way, it's simple to include a cosmological constant term. So if you have the integral of simple cosmological constant term, then obviously that just becomes sum over the volume of the simplices of the highest dimension. So we'll want to work out the volumes of the n-dimensional simplices as well as the n-2-dimensional simplices if we have a term like this in. Well, the volume, the formula, is something which I think in John Wheeler's article in Relativity Groups and Topology, he attributes it to some Greek mathematician, but I can't remember the name. But anyway, it's a very nice formula. I think this is the easiest formula for the volume, easiest to remember. It's the formula for the square of the volume of an n-dimensional simplex. And we suppose that this simplex has vertices 0, 1, 2, up to n, and that the edge lengths are labeled by the ends which they connect. So this formula is in terms of a determinant. What you get is minus 1 to the n plus 1 over 2. You might think that gives you an imaginary volume sometimes, but in fact, you always get a positive answer for this. N factorial 2 to the n over 2 on the bottom. And then you get a determinant which has zeros all down the diagonal. Ones otherwise in the first row and column. And then what you get is, I'll write in terms of the squared edge lengths, actually, to mean I don't have to keep on writing squares. What you get here is S01, which is, let me write Sij equals Lij squared. S01, S02, all the way up to S0n It's a symmetric determinant. And then the next row you get S12, S13, all the way up to S1n. I think you can see how it's going to work out. And then that's to the half. So that's the formula for the volume. Another formula is the n squared is 1 over n factorial squared. It's another thing in terms of determinant. The determinant of EI dot EJ, where EI dot EJ is equal to a half of S naught I plus S naught J minus Sij. And EI dot EI is just S naught I. So that's another, well, actually this is probably easier to remember than that one, but this is another formula. In fact, this is a formula which gives the metric in a flat simplex. So this actually gives Gij. If you use coordinates where you choose one vertex as the origin and then take the edges emanating from that one vertex to be the coordinate directions, then the metric within that simplex is given by this formula. So that's Gij in coordinates where vertices are 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, etc. Now, what about dihedral angles? You can always calculate them from first principles by setting up unit normals to simplicial faces and finding angles between the unit normals. But there are some nice formulae. And the nicest one here is for the sine of a dihedral angle. So suppose you've got a hinge of volume Vn minus 2 between faces of volumes Vn minus 1 and Vn minus 1 prime in a simplex of volume Vn, then sine theta is given by n, a numerical factor, n over n minus 1, Vn minus 2 times Vn over Vn minus 1, Vn minus 1 prime. So if you had a tetrahedron, here n is 3, so we'd get 3 halves. And then if this is the hinge we're looking at, and this is the angle we want, we'd get L times the volume of the tetrahedron, and then we'd have to divide by the area of this front face and the area of the bottom face, so in A prime. So that's a nice, simple formula. The complication with this is that sine of an angle doesn't distinguish between theta and pi minus theta. So you might sometimes want to find the cosine to choose between those two. And probably the easiest formula for the cosine is given by, this is actually going to be in terms of some differential forms. Again, on the bottom, we have the product of the volumes of the faces. And then on the top, omega n is the wedge product of E1, wedge E2, up to En. So this is the volume form associated with an N simplex. With vectors, the E1 up to En are the vectors from the chosen vertex to the other vertices. Well, as I said, there's a lot of mathematical formalism which corresponds with all of this. And obviously there isn't time to write down lots of formulae, but I want to mention one set of relations which can be quite useful. And before doing that, I need to tell you what a simplicial manifold is. Because you can set up a collection of blocks according to this sort of recipe, and it's not necessarily a manifold. So I'll define that, and then I'll mention something called the Dane-Somerville relations. So I said a simplicial complex isn't necessarily a manifold. But before I define that, I need to define a couple of other things. One of them is the star of a vertex, and the other is the link. So the star of a vertex in a simplicial complex is the collection of all simplices of any dimension which actually share that vertex. And then there's something rather similar called the link, where you basically take the star and then subtract away the subsimplices which actually contain the vertex. So the link of a vertex is the star minus the simplices and subsimplices, which are simplices still. Now that may sound a bit contradictory, but let me just illustrate it in two dimensions. So let's suppose we've got a collection of triangles. And we'll focus on this vertex here and differentiate between the star and the link. So the star is actually all the simplices and subsimplices which contain that vertex. So it's the edges going into that vertex plus also the triangles that contain that vertex. So the link is all of that, including these edges of the triangles around here. And then to get the link, sorry, that's the star. To get the link, we have to subtract off the bits of those simplices which actually contain the vertex. So we don't have these edges anymore, and we don't have the interiors of these triangles. All we get is this sort of boundary here. So it's just this collection of edges that go around it. So you can think of it as the boundary of that region there. Now, the point of defining that is that the condition for a simplicial manifold is that the link of a vertex has to be homeomorphic to a sphere of dimension n minus 1. And you can see in this case, when we're in two dimensions, we want the link to be homeomorphic to a sphere of dimension 1, which is a circle, which is exactly what we've got here. So for a simplicial manifold, link of any vertex homeomorphic to a sphere of dimension n minus 1. And it's basically the same condition as for an ordinary manifold. You want any point locally to be equivalent to flat space. It's a definition. I think that's necessary and sufficient. I'm talking about manifolds without boundaries, by the way. I'm leaving boundaries out at the moment. And then the Dane-Somerville relations give some formulae which connect numbers of subsimplices in a simplicial manifold. So, one relation I'll write down. This is in a 2n-dimensional simplicial manifold, so that's the dimension there, in 2n sub p, which is the number of simplices of dimension p in this manifold. It's a sum from I equals 1 to 2n minus 1 to the I, and then a combinatorial factor, I plus 1, P plus 1, N I, 2N. So N I, 2N equals number of simplices of dimension I in this 2N dimensional manifold. Um, And this gives various useful relations. A certain number of relations which are independent. They're not all independent, but it gives relations like, if we've got a four manifold, it gives you that twice the number of tetrahedra is five times the number of four simplices. Now, you can actually argue that sort of thing anyway by thinking about, if you have a simplicial complex, you don't want two four simplices to meet on more than one tetrahedron. A single tetrahedron will be the boundary between two four simplices. And if you argue about numbers in that sort of way, you can come up with this relation, but it's a direct consequence of the Dane-Somerville relations if you take P equals 2. And the Euler character is given by a similar formula. Chi to n is sum from I equals 0 to 2n minus 1 to the I times ni to n. And these sort of relations are useful, and they certainly found a use in dynamical triangulations where you can actually simplify the action by using the relations between the numbers of simplices of different dimensions. There are lots of variants on this. You can obtain relations involving, rather than having this formula, you can get relations involving the number of even dimensional subsimplices, and you can also get relations involving number of the even dimensional deficit angles. And it's quite fun because you get formulae where the coefficients are related to Bernoulli numbers. I think the Dane-Somerville relations are for even-dimensional manifolds, but I didn't have the original paper with me, so I'm not absolutely sure. I mean, there certainly are relations in odd-dimensional manifolds as well, but I'm not sure whether they're of that form or not. Now, when I wrote down the Regi equations, I said something about, in principle, we can solve them uniquely because there seem to be the same number of equations as variables. I had a note of caution, and that note of caution is because there isn't necessarily the sort of match between the number of independent equations and variables that you might want. Regi calculus actually has its own Bianchi identities, and so that means that not all of the equations are going to be independent in general. So let me say something about Bianchi identities. Regi already talked about Bianchi identities in his original paper, and he showed that they've got a very beautiful topological interpretation. And it's easiest to see that in three dimensions. So first of all, these exist in Regi calculus, and there's this topological interpretation. And I'll describe that in three dimensions. In two dimensions, there aren't Bianchi identities either in the continuum or in Regi calculus. But let's suppose, well, first of all, if we parallel transport a vector about a path enclosing an edge in three dimensions, then if the deficit at that edge is zero, the vector won't rotate. But if the deficit is non-zero, the vector will rotate. So for path not enclosing edges, parallel transport produces no rotation. Now let's consider a path. Let's suppose we've got a vertex here with four edges meeting at it. So in three dimensions, the hinges are the edges, and the path we'll consider will look like this. So, let's put some arrows in. Now, we've got a closed path there, and it seems to encircle each of those edges. But in fact, this path is topologically trivial. We can deform it into the identity. If we pull it, it will actually come away from everything. These loops will come round the back here. It doesn't look very obvious where I've drawn it, but it is topologically trivial. So this path actually encircles no edge. And that means that the product of the rotation matrices corresponding to the path must actually be equal to the identity matrix. So what you'll get is the product over the hinges I of exponential deficit angle times the rotation generator, which is again this U which I defined a while ago. That should give the identity. So the Bianchi identities in Regi calculus are of that form. Two more minutes, thank you. So what would we have in four dimensions? What we would get in four dimensions would be that the product of rotation matrices for all the triangles meeting on an edge . So what you get in general dimension is, if you look at the hinges, the n minus 2 dimensional subspaces, subsimplices, meeting on some n minus 3 dimensional simplex, the product of the rotation matrices for those will actually be equal to the identity. Regi showed that in the limit of small deficit angles, if you expand the exponentials and keep only the terms of order epsilon, then you actually get the continuum Bianchi identities. So the Reggie calculus Bianchi identities are exact, but they're only an approximation to the continuum Bianchi identities, or vice versa. So where does that leave us as far as finding classical solutions goes? If the equations are not all independent, well, what that means is very similar to what happens in the continuum. If you take the 3 plus 1 ADM formalism, then because of the Bianchi identities, not all the relativity equations, the general relativity equations, are independent, and you can freely specify the Laplace function and the shift vector. And so in the same sort of way here, it seems that the existence of the Reggie calculus Bianchi identities will mean that there should be some freedom to specify some variables analogous to Laplace and shift. And then one would use the equations, the independent equations, to solve for the others. Well, I think I've run out of time. I was hoping to get through diffeomorphisms as well, but I better stop. Okay.